Hey, good evening, Steele.
Good evening, Dave. How's it going?
Great. I had some downtime at work today, so I was reading Dune for a few
Whoa,
minutes.
Mod Deep.
Whenever I actually had a patient to go see, I was kind of mad. I was like, come on, don't they know where I'm at? Like, the Harkonnens are attacking. This is ridiculous.
Yeah,
But,
that's a vicious family.
you don't want to
Atreides till I
mess with
die,
them.
man. Atreides, whatever they're called.
Atreides, you
Atreides.
got a pronunciation guide in the back.
Hey Dave, and if it's possible, could you turn up that blinding light over your head so I could get a bit more of that?
I think I could angle the camera so that it's a little bit more,
Nice.
just in your
This is
face.
more of a corona. It's like a total eclipse of the Dave.
I don't. I'm sorry. I don't have a podcast studio like you.
Hey, well,
I apologize.
one day they'll build one in Snowflake.
I don't think so. But still, I'm excited.
Me too.
We have one of our oldest friends, not in age, but just in time that we've known him. And you've known him longer than me, so maybe you can introduce him.
This is Mark Ellison. Mark was the first guy that I met and liked at college, my first day of like welcome week. It was the best. And then I found out he lived next door to me, which made it perfect.
Oh.
Mark, welcome to Off the Chain.
Thanks, guys. I have this like distinct memory of meeting Steele walking at the end of this breakfast line right outside the Smithfield House, and Steele's got these cool blue Nikes with the yellow swoosh, and he like does a spin move, and I was like, "Hey!" And it was just an immediate connection.
Yep, you had me at hey, Mark.
Well, Mark, before we get into the episode, I have a quick, I think, pretty important question for you.
Yeah, Bernie. Yeah.
It's a series of questions, actually. One, did you ever get your tuberculosis treated? And two, does your chronic coughing fit in the morning? Does that wake up your son? Is this an issue in your life still? Every day of college that I shared a house with Mark, it began with Mark coughing for about 5 minutes.
The walls of the house would shake, windows rattling, and we're like, oh man, that's old cadaver Pete in the basement.
Yeah, but what was actually happening is I had a chewing tobacco problem, and it made me cough every morning. But
Not
no,
supposed to swallow that stuff, Mark.
it doesn't say that on the label, Steele.
You watch The
Anyway,
Sandlot?
it's funny. I don't know if that house had like some mold that I was sensitive to or something, but from
Certainly,
the day
almost
I moved
certainly,
out of
yes.
there, the leftover from that couch that we cut in half and then dropped out the window because we couldn't get it out of the house. From the day that I left, I have not experienced that.
Wow, that's
But
wonderful.
I would say it was
I
a
don't know.
gift, really. It was a gift for all of us. We all remember it, appreciated it. Did you have health
Well,
insurance at the time, Mark?
I'm pretty sure I was on my parents' plan until I was 23, and then I must have gotten some kind of cheap health insurance. But yeah, I never went to the doctor about it though.
That's
Just
for
like
sure. No, why
stiff
coughing
upper
up
lip.
blood every morning, that's fine. Yeah, no problem.
Tuberculosis.
Dave was telling me last episode that that's the number one reason why he went into healthcare. He decided to become a male nurse because it was just the memory of his roommate nearly dying each morning traumatized him. And he's like, I can't let people live like this.
Yeah, now I could give you some prescriptions for the tuberculosis. It's a long course of antibiotics, but we beat it, buddy. We wouldn't stop. We'd do it.
I did a little bit of research on this as well, Dave. I don't know if you know, but I found a list of other great men besides Mark whose lives were destroyed too young by tuberculosis. Did
Oh,
you
no.
know
Yeah,
that
share.
tuberculosis killed King Tut?
No,
Yeah.
that's it, huh?
Yeah, that was what did it. Baruch Spinoza, the great philosopher. Simon Bolivar, the Latin American revolutionary. Edgar Allan Poe, the poet, short story writer, inventor of the detective story, felled before his time by tuberculosis.
Yeah, they found him dead in the street or something, right?
Yeah, I think he was also suffering from some STDs and
Alcoholism
drunkenness,
or
and
yeah.
it was like injecting lead directly into his veins, kind of thing. He was pretty dissolute. I think he was struggling. But John Keats, the great romantic poet, Robert Louis Stevenson, the guy who gave us Treasure Island and Kidnapped! Mm-hmm. Exclamation mark.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And Dr. Jekyll, right?
Correct. Who could forget Mm-mm. Dr. Jekyll? Couldn't cure his tuberculosis, but could Mm-mm. savagely murder people. Right? Isn't that what Dr. Jekyll did? Mr. Hyde? Which one? I don't know.
Mr. Hyde was the murderer, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And George
like
Orwell.
Sociopath. Like.
Sociopath. Dime a dozen. George Orwell also died of tuberculosis. Great Animal Farm, 1984. Road to Wigan Pier. So, Mark, you were in good company. When it kills you before your 40th birthday, we will say Mark Elison, up there among the great, felled by tuberculosis.
Yeah, you will be mourned. But we warned you. You should have gone to the doctor about this at some point in the last 15 years. You should have done
I've been holding on pretty well, though.
I might hold the record of
longest running case of tuberculosis.
Of untreated tuberculosis, yeah. Well, now that we got that settled, Dave, what do we got on the docket for today?
Well, I'm excited. We're going to do some small talk. And, of course, we got Mark here. He's an expert in many areas. We're going to get some testimony from him. And, of course, we've got a very special Unchained Melodies. Just a hint, The Edge is going to be involved in Unchained Melodies. And Mark's got some book wisdom for us. But let's start off with some small talk. Quick update, just so you know, small talk. We give you stories to share when you're in your awkward social situation. You don't know what to say. Just bring this up. People are going to like you. People will think you're intelligent and funny and have something interesting to say. So this is what we were supplying you with. I was reading an article about garbage men in New York City.
Of course. At least one a week. We all read at least an article a week about New York City garbage men. Can't get enough of those little guys. So interesting.
They got so much to say, so much to tell. But the crux of the article is that if you want to make over $100,000 a year and not have a high school diploma, the place to do it is New York City as a garbage man. If you're driving the truck, you can make like $110,000, $115,000. If you're just one of the helper dudes, you're making about an even $100,000. These guys, they bring in bank.
Wow.
How long do they typically last? I mean, like, can you be a garbage man till you're in your 60s?
Before the rats eat them?
Or you get swallowed by a garbage monster?
So much can happen. It's like Alaska fishermen and New York City garbage men, the two most perilous occupations on Earth.
I think you could probably last really well with it, Mark. You've survived 15 years with tuberculosis. Like, I don't think driving a garbage truck would really hurt you. It might. I don't know if it would be a pay raise or not. I don't know where you're at there, but it's good pay. It's good work.
The highlight of Cedar's morning this morning, the garbage truck comes, and they come pick up our recycling bin right outside of our bedroom window. So he goes and runs in his room, stands on his bed, says, see, and he can look out the window. And he watched the recycling truck take the recycling bins. And this one has Bucky on its side because it's a University of Wisconsin one. He was literally glued to the window for like 5 minutes just watching them do all their work. It was like TV, but better.
See, it's an exciting job, too.
Yeah.
They enjoy it. They're not out there just slogging through life. It's great. It's exciting.
This guy appeared to be in his late 50s, too, Dave, in answer to your question. This guy was doing it alone. He didn't have the young kid with him. He was driving it, loading it up, mm-hmm. push the button, dumping it, putting it back, hopping back in, driving to the next spot. And he was hustling too. That guy's brisk pace.
You know, here's an interesting point about garbage men. There's a lot of, apparently in the sanitation business, there's a lot of connections to kind of corrupt, maybe like mob bosses or corrupt politicians. Like in Chicago, all of the alderman districts, one of the like rules written into law for Chicago City law is that each alderman chooses their own sanitation garbage men, I guess. Uh-huh. And so Chicago's full of tons of tiny garbage companies.
The old patronage spoil system now is for aldermen and their garbage workers.
Pretty much. You just like make a connection with your alderman, and your alderman, you can maybe like give him kickbacks or something. So working for right now, he's several times looked at several different kind of sanitation companies, and he was telling me that it's very common for them to be connected with mob bosses and stuff. And he's done work in sanitation, and he's also done work in gaming. So sometimes when he gets into conversations with people, they'll be like, Andy, is there something we need to know about you? Are you on the up and up? Because he's got the connection to the gaming and the sanitation.
There's a lot of money in sanitation. And if you're going to dispose of a dead body, there's two ways to do it. One, in the garbage truck, or two, feed it to live pigs. So, of course, mobs are going to be interested in sanitation.
Yeah. And that totally makes sense.
So, yeah, the money in sanitation. That's small talk number one. Who's got something else for us?
I do.
Okay, all right. What is it, Steele?
I just thought you just want to know who else had something. Yeah, so I'll tell you what I've got as well. So what do you guys know about professional flatulence?
I don't know. It sounds like something I might be able to try my hand at.
Well. Yeah, if you're looking for a side career, I read this amazing article, a long article about the long, illustrious history of professional farters. There was a guy from the 12th century English king, Henry II. His name was Roland. He was the court minstrel. He was known as Roland Le Sarcer, Roland Le Farter, Roland Le Petur, and Roland the Farter. One job in court. Every Christmas, during the big pageant, he performs a dance that ends with one jump, one whistle, and one fart, which he executed simultaneously. For his great performance, his ability to fart hilariously on command, he was granted a manor house and more than 100 acres of land. So that's like the opening anecdote to this article. And I read that, sucked me in, man. It was amazing.
Is professional farting, is this still going on? Can I get a career in this?
Well, it existed until very recently. There's a bunch of stuff in the Middle Ages. There's a bunch of stuff kind of through the traveling circuses and stuff like that. What started happening was the internet and the YouTube. There is a guy.
Yes.
It's a struggling profession now, but there's a guy from England, of course. He performed in Britain's Got Talent in 2009. His name's Paul Oldfield, but he goes by the name of Mr. Methane. And he wears like a green spandex suit with purple He-Man underwear and like a little mask, and he has incredible farting power, can fart. He has great control of his sphincter. He's able to inhale air into the sphincter and then push it back out on demand. He can make three tones with his farts. He's kind of musical. There's no smell because the air that's coming in and out isn't from digesting gases. It's just pulled in and out on demand. But he's got the ability to make sound and to expel air and to do it for great effect. So he had a brief career as a train engineer, and then he said, you know, I'm going to do this professionally. I'm going to become a professional farter. So for the last 20 or so years, he's made the circuit. Late night talk shows, radio shows, TV spots. Sinead O'Connor ordered 20 copies of his Merry Christmas album, or his Merry, and his Let's Rip DVD. That's his DVD.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
There's got to be still some demand, though, Steele, for maybe like a live performer at like a birthday party or something, right?
Right. I think that's kind of what he's been reduced to. He doesn't do the big crowds. Probably corporate events every once in a while, you know. Yeah. Stock report's going to be bad. What can we do to kind of break the tension, liven it up?
Mr. Methane.
Yeah, Mr. Methane's here.
Guys, I still remember one night where I stumbled upon this discovery that I could fart on command. And I was doing exactly what Mr. Methane was doing. I was like, wow, I've got this. And then I lost it. It was just one night that I could do it. I could have been Mr. Methane, but I lost the skill. I don't know what happened, but that was a magical evening.
Ah, Dave, that's like one of those, I bought the winning lottery ticket and then I accidentally left it in my jeans and they went through the wash kind of story.
Yeah, so close to fame and fortune. So close.
Steele, is there any kind of long-term impact if you're a prolific farter?
I don't think they're doing any damage. I mean, if they're ingesting foreign objects up there and if they're lighting fires and stuff like that, there could be danger of burns, you know? You don't want the flame too close. It didn't sound like Mr. Methane is suffering any adverse effects. They talked about this 19th century French sensation, Le Petitman, like the farting maniac. That was a huge sensation. He used to do private shows for very wealthy people in the nude so they could see the mechanism up close. But I think he just lived a long, healthy, prosperous life. I don't think he suffered any damage except back pain from carrying too much gold around.
Now, what about, did the article confirm anything about beans being any kind of a musical fruit?
Oh, you know, it didn't, you know, they didn't research that. But it did say, I will tell you this, do you guys know what the world's oldest joke is?
I'm assuming it's fart related.
Yes, that's what the historians believe. Sumeria, 1900 BC. Something which has never occurred since time immemorial. A young woman did not fart in her husband's lap. Apparently that was like a joke to crack up a 20th century BC Sumerian.
No, when is a fart not funny? If you're sitting down for a meal, you're farting, like everybody's going to enjoy that. Everybody.
So I think farts have staying power, I'll say.
They linger. They linger.
They linger long in the memory. So anyway, tell me that's not something you can talk about at your next party, Dave. When you're like, they're like, oh, I've heard it. If they've already heard of the Panuma, just bring up the fart jokes.
So, Mark, awesome. What do you got for us tonight, buddy?
I've been doing actually some pretty interesting research recently. I'm working on a project at work right now that's all about trucking, trucking industry.
I'm worried you fundamentally misunderstand small talk. You mentioned research and work. But go ahead.
Well, so let me ask you guys. Can you name the modes of transport by which we move freight around in this country? Let's see if you can name them.
Yeah.
Canal. Train.
Train. Okay. Rail.
Rail. And obviously trucking.
Trucking.
Helicopters.
Oh, Dave. Hot air balloon. Hot air balloon's way more popular for moving freight. Container ship. A ton of stuff comes on container. There's enormous container ships.
That's true. So, yep. Up and down rivers as well. Pipeline.
What?
Yep.
Oh, you're talking about oil?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of freight, right?
Yeah.
You're moving it around.
What about pneumatic tubes? Pneumatic tubes? We use them at Walgreens to send our...
We should probably be doing more pneumatic tubes is the reality. No, but the other one is intermodal. Do you guys know what intermodal is? Have you heard of that?
Intermodal? No.
I'm not familiar with that.
So intermodal is the ship container comes in on the ship. They pick it up and they put it straight on a truck. And then from a truck, it goes straight to the back of onto a rail car. So they're just moving the shipping container from mode to mode.
Wow.
It's the name. Fantastic. Intermodal.
So it's like a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Now here's the kicker.
Okay.
Oh, this is interesting dinner conversation. Let's do this.
How much freight do you guys think we move on an annual basis in the United States?
Are you talking about the Ellison family or are you talking about the United States as a country?
Let's start with the country and we can work our way down.
Oh.
Just take a guess.
Are we talking pounds of freight or what are we talking?
We're talking tons. 3 trillion tons.
That's high.
I'm going to back off a little bit. I'm going to say 650 million tons.
Whoa, that's a good guess.
Oh, okay.
Billions of tons.
Billions. That's in the billions then.
15 billion.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
3 trillion is a little high though. A little high.
Yeah.
That's probably more than the entire Earth weighs. I don't even know. 15 billion tons get moved.
Yeah, I thought that was crazy. 15 billion tons. Yeah.
Wow. Talk about logistics. That's some small talk dinner conversation. Hey, what do you guys know about logistics? Supply chain.
Yeah. It's about moving stuff from A to B.
And farting is not. That's the thing. It's just all smoke, no fire.
You're moving something. So what's your favorite mode of freight shipping? Mark, do you have something that's your favorite?
Intermodal, I think, is just so cool because you've got a crane picking it up off the ship, putting it on a truck, putting it on a train.
It's something for everybody. The whole family can get involved in intermodal.
And for some reason, I pictured a giant hamster ball being used at some point during the intermodal shipping. So I would love if we could work that in.
That's how you get it downhill. You just use the power of gravity. You don't have to use as much fuel. You just put it in the hamster ball at the top of the hill and
roll it down.
Yeah.
Green shipping, guys. It's green.
The streets of San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly.
Are full of hamster balls.
Look out! Intermodal freight shipment coming through.
So, guys, I'm excited about this next segment. We're just going to get into Mark Elison, his different levels of expertise.
Yeah.
Because, Mark, you just brought up your job, and I've got a few quick questions for you. You work for Bain Capital. Is that correct?
I work for Bain and Company.
Bain and
Close
Company.
To Bain Capital. It's a sister company of Bain Capital.
Bain and
okay,
Company.
So does this mean that you actually work for the Batman villain or just in a sister company of his company?
Yeah, so it's his theater troupe, and I'm part of the company. Bain and Company.
Nice. So do you guys how do you split royalties on this?
Oh, it's like 90% Bain, 10% the rest of the team. But we all we can understand that anyone who's ever asked for a raise has ended up in the sewer. So.
Those New York City aldermen and their garbage workers.
Yeah, Bain's got them all under his thumb.
So can you give us word on when the Gotham City takeover might be taking place?
Yeah, insider traders want to know.
Yeah. So word on the street is he's actually backing off Gotham City.
Oh,
he's got his eyes on another city,
metropolitan city,
Metropolis.
Yeah, that's
is
what
it
I meant.
Yeah.
Damn it! I can't even get my Superman reference right.
Metropolis. Yeah, that's right.
Metropolitan City Incorporated.
What do you actually do? What do you actually do? I have no idea.
Oh. I'm an actor. It's funny. When people ask me this, I always feel a little bit dumb saying it because I'm a consultant.
Yeah, me too.
Which basically, steals a consultant as well.
Yeah.
It basically means I work on a team with people to solve kind of general business type problems.
So, Dave, he's like a nurse practitioner of a company.
He's figuring out why the company's constipated. You're going to figure out what's constipating the company. And
pretty
you're going to give it the lactulose.
Leeches. Yeah. It's leeches every time, Dave. It must apply leeches.
One time we tried to give a company a catheter one time. It just didn't work out that well. As I'm sure you could imagine, Dave. But.
So what are you looking at? Is it you just do you just work with companies in specific areas of business, or can you go into any company and start helping them figure out what's going wrong? Like, what do you do? Yeah.
The types of problems we solve are fairly similar across companies, but we can go into basically any industry and work in any industry. And right now, the types of projects I'm working on are specifically with private equity clients who are basically really rich people buying companies, holding on to them, and then selling them later. And what we do for these guys is we basically kick the tires on the company and tell them whether or not like the company and the market itself is worth investing in.
So it sounds like – so this is humanitarian work then, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
I never thought Dave would be more of a cynic about your job than I would, Mark, but he clearly is.
No. How long have you been doing it now?
It's been about a year and a half.
Most interesting place you've traveled to?
So actually, on my first case, I was traveling all over Europe. And in one day, we were in like 7 different countries because we drove from Zurich. It was 6 different countries. We drove from Zurich through Germany and France up through Luxembourg, Belgium, and into the Netherlands. And
so you really took time to savor them all.
Pretty much. As crazy as you're coming out of I think it's Luxembourg is like super well lit the whole time on the highways. It's like a street lamp every 20 feet. And then right when you cross into the Netherlands, it's just darkness.
Nice.
Into the abyss.
Metaphor. How much time do you have to spend on the road?
Depends on the project. I was on a project for like 8 months that was like on the road 4 days a week the whole time, pretty much. That was about the – that's about as bad as it gets.
Are you not allowed to say worst? They don't let you use the word worst at Bain?
It's pretty much the worst.
Okay.
And for that one, I was traveling to the south. And
double
so it was
worst.
Nice to get out of the winter a little bit in Chicago, but I don't know.
You know, it was the south.
Exactly.
It seems like the difficulty there would be in the south, you're just going to put on weight. Like, I would just be eating fried chicken all the time.
Yeah. They have this place in the town where I was working. It's like bottomless fried chicken for 20 bucks. It was bad. You pay 20 bucks and they just keep bringing you baskets of fried chicken.
Oh man, that's what we need in Snowflake, Arizona.
Yeah,
I'd be there right now.
Business is good.
Called the Matinee Inn. Come on down to the Matinee Inn.
Nice. So, Mark, other question about the job. In the course of your travels, in the course of your consulting, how has it changed your travel skills? Like, you become an experienced business traveler. What's like one takeaway lesson that the rest of us mere mortals who travel just on vacation should learn?
Oh man, for a very small fee, you can buy status called pre-check, which means you skip the lines and you don't have to take your laptop out of your bag.
Is this the TSA pre-approved thing?
Yeah.
Man, I've seen TSA people skipping lines and I always wondered how they did it.
Well, and I'll tell you, like the not having to unpack your bags or like take your belt off or take your shoes off, when you're traveling a lot, like you totally feel that, you know? I know, it sounds ridiculous.
No, it sounds good.
No, yeah.
I just never wear belts and I always wear like slip-on shoes when I'm going to the airport just because of that. But if I could dress how I wanted to,
that'd be
a whole different life.
Yes. A lot more leather would be in your wardrobe at the airport if you could.
I'd be like one of the guys from The Village People.
So are you involved in all the frequent traveler programs? You're getting all sorts of points and stuff?
Yeah, dude. I mean, so the upside of that 8 month case where I was traveling all the time is Jana and Augie and I just went to Hawaii for like 8 days basically for free. Like the whole thing. That was pretty awesome.
What have been the core principles of business that have been important for your job? Like when you're advising the companies, is it basically like, oh yeah, okay, you need to figure out a way to make more money and spend less money, or is there something else more complex involved?
Yeah, I mean it largely varies from client to client, but like mostly it's about making money or spending less money.
There you go. See, I didn't even need an MBA, Dave. I just solved it. Business.
And Mark, this leads me into the other area of question I wanted to go into. Because you and I, we've been friends for a long time, but as long as I've known you, you've been doing some sort of schooling or another. How many advanced degrees do you have at this point? Can you just walk me through what you have?
Yeah, so this is a fact that I'm like somewhat embarrassed about, but I do have I have a bachelor's degree.
Nice.
Yes. And on top of a bachelor's degree, English.
In English? Nice. Good
in English. And I have three advanced degrees.
Yeah, they call three. The tripod. Yep. The tripod.
So,
what are your advanced degrees?
One of them I kind of just got hornswoggled into, which was so I got a master's in education, which, I mean, it's great if you know that's what
no
you're
value
doing,
there.
If you hate your life, I mean, if you hate your life, bankrupt your future. Yeah, go ahead and study education for a while. If you can't do, teach, right, Mark?
Exactly. And if you can't teach, consult. That's what I say.
Exactly. But that's been my career trajectory, exactly, but I've stayed in the academy for it. It's been awesome.
No, so when I graduated from BYU, I joined Teach for America, and I came down to be a high school, like a cool high school teacher, inner city kids, et cetera. You know, I was like caught up in kind of the cool notion of it. And I loved studying English, and I was like, this is so empowering and cool. But little did I know, there was like a kind of a basically a requirement for us to enroll in a master's program. Hmm. And they gave us a huge discount. So luckily I'm not like in debt from the program, but anyway, the story there. And I got my master's in education from ASU, after which point I took a year off of school, actually.
Oh, wow. A whole year.
Took a year off of school.
A gap year.
Yeah, exactly. But I was actually still working for schools because I was working as a consultant within education. And then I met the woman who I would marry, and she was in law school, and I thought, why not? So I followed her to law school. She was at BYU, and I said, all right, I've always wanted to get a law degree, time as any. But, you know, it's about a year into that that I was like, you know, I actually don't really want to do this. And that's when I started applying to MBA schools. So I did like a JD and 11? The MBA at the same time. Over just the course of 4 years.
Point of comparison.
That's how you do it.
That was like 11 months longer than it took Dave to realize he didn't want to do this. Is that right, Dave?
But that's actually a couple years shorter than most lawyers, because they do the whole 3 years and then they're like, wait, well, I don't want to do this, but there's no choice at that point.
That's
so.
Jordan. That's Jordan's story.
Yeah. It took me the first day of law school. I was like, oh, geez. Things are going wrong here really quickly.
It's funny. I'm in an award with all these attorneys or all these law students, and you know they're at University of Chicago, which they have like great options coming out of there. But there's so many guys who are like, I don't know if this is really what I want to do.
Yeah, well, hey, you only flushed $200,000 down the toilet in making that discovery, so.
Steele, did you ever think about law school? I mean, Dave and I both thought about law school.
No way. No way. Yeah.
It never even crossed your mind.
I don't know if – I'm sure it's crossed my mind, but I never researched schools. I never considered applications. I never did any of that kind of stuff that might be a serious step towards doing it. So
– yeah.
You still could, Steele. It's not too late, buddy.
Yeah, when you talk about being a student, I have been a full-time student since age 4, continuously. Actually, not continuously, but I've never spent a full year not being a full-time student since
age 4.
Except
on your mission.
I was a full-time student, man.
That's true, the gospel. You didn't study it well enough.
The Lord's University, Dave. I just took an incomplete, that's all.
This last summer was actually the first summer where I haven't had like a summer break, basically.
They don't give you breaks at Bain & Company?
I know.
The touring season doesn't
No, you'd think that Bain would take a break from terrorizing society for at least a little while.
No way. No rest.
You
no
gotta
rest
stay your Interpol profile has to shrink back down because it gets too high.
That's the thing. The summertime is like it's the really busy season for the theater villains. You know, Christmas Carol in the summertime, Les Mis, everything.
So,
Les Mis, yeah.
I have a couple questions for you. Have you guys figured out your son's preschool placement yet? I know it's pretty important. Cutthroat world that is Chicago, getting him in the right school, in the right preschool, in the right pre-pre-preschool, in the right pre-preparatory school, in the right waiting list for the pre-pre-pre-preparatory school. I mean, where are you guys at with all that?
Yeah, I think our approach is he spends all day every day with someone who has an advanced degree, who's probably one of the smartest people I know. Mm. And that's a pretty good investment, and that's where we're at.
Okay.
What about you guys?
I only see him on the weekends. I have no idea what he does with the rest of his time.
He's got a bookie business on the side.
Probably. I think he's trying to work an alderman, get a contract thrown his way to do some garbage disposal. He's scouting out the competition today. That's why he was watching Bucky.
We need to get Augie and Cedar together sometime. Sounds like they've got some common interests. Music, garbage men, trucks, probably.
Yeah. All the single ladies.
All the single ladies.
And, well, that's a universal interest for all humanity, so it's a fantastic song.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Have you started teaching August strategic sayings? I know that, Mark, you're famous in our circle for having a bunch of, like, super dorky dad sayings before you ever became a dad. Now that you are a dad, are they in circulation?
Apparently I've become more cool as I've aged because those are, yeah, they've been phased out. Now it's a, what is that? Or, what are you doing?
That doesn't go in your mouth. Not now. Cool.
No.
As you guys can imagine.
Okay, Doggy, I hope you fall from there because then you'll learn your lesson.
That's what I was just going to say. I'm guessing you guys can probably imagine, but I'm more of the kind of laissez-faire reason with your child kind of parent. Like Cedar will be doing something dangerous and I'll be like, all right, Cedar, that looks pretty dangerous. If I were you, I wouldn't do that, and just wait for him to decide. And then sometimes he falls, but it works pretty well.
Well, we were playing some board games tonight, and after like the third warning of not putting the pieces in your mouth, I had to be, guys, next person to put a piece in their mouth, they're out of the game. They're done. They're not allowed to play anymore.
Did you enforce the rule?
I didn't have to. Once I got all the way to there, everybody's like, Oh, Dad is serious about this board game pieces in the mouth business. So, and I was.
Were you guys playing Candyland? That's one of your favorites.
I don't understand why I don't have that game. It makes no sense. We're playing something with squirrels in it. I mean,
come on. You don't have Candyland?
No.
How are they going to understand the joys of gumdrop castles and gingerbread fat forests and all that stuff?
They know the joys of candy. Okay. Don't worry, guys. They understand.
That's good. But, you're doing your job.
But Mark, the topic that I wanted to get into, do you have anything else you want to talk about before we get into what Mark is really known for, his expertise?
No, I mean, everybody knows this about Mark. Probably the world's greatest U2 superfan.
He understands you too.
My brother Tom might be a little bit greater, but.
Whoa. That's true. Tom, the Elison family's second greatest YouTube super fan. First question. Where did the passion begin?
It all started actually with our good friend, our mutual friend, Dan Jenajohn.
What?
Oh, no.
I was in a car with Dan Jenajohn and Alan Stopher and
Bad
John
choice.
Stopher.
Bad life choices.
And we were all, what, like 13 or something like that.
Even worse life choices. Who was driving the car then?
I think it was Dan's older brother. Or something.
Oh, okay. But
yeah, so this was 1995. We were all about 13. Dan's older brother was driving, and they popped in this U2 greatest hits tape. And here's an interesting story is my older siblings always liked U2. When I was younger, I'd always been like, U2, they're totally lame to my older sibling. Mm-hmm. But then when we started playing it in the car, and Dan was like, this is so cool. And Alan was like, yeah, this is cool. I was like, yeah, this is so cool. You know, just jumping on the bandwagon. And true story of fake it till you make it, because, you know, as I professed my love for U2 while I was like secretly thinking, oh, but I've always thought these guys are lame. Slowly over time, I just came to love all their songs, their sound, their vibe. It's funny because, I mean, over the course of my life, like, they've, like, spoken to me, you know? And that's where the passion comes from.
Yes. And that's what we want to get into, I think, a little bit. Them speaking to you, Mark.
You know, like, when I'm in the bathroom and I'm like, yeah, Bono, I should probably shave right now. All right. Cool.
I was holding my breath for what Bono's telling you to do in the bathroom there, Mark. Could have gone so many directions.
Boom.
Is that the joke? Is that, okay, what? Good.
You guys have dirty minds. I don't know what you're talking about.
Wait, so Mark, honestly, how do you think your love of U2 has affected your life? What has it done for you?
If I'm totally honest about it, there have been times and places in my life where I've been like struggling with one thing or another, and a U2 lyric came to my mind and helped me resolve the situation, you know? Like, I remember there's this one time,
So
there's this one time on
no
my.
biggie, Dave, just direct answer to prayer and like basic life guidance revelation, you know, small stuff.
Pretty much.
It's Bono. He does that for everybody.
There's this one time on my mission when I was having some kind of challenge, and suddenly mysterious ways popped into my mind, and I'm like, God, he just moves in mysterious ways. And it was cool.
I have a mission story that relates to you too as well, Mark, and you'll appreciate this. I don't know if I've ever told this before, but I was having a tough time on my mission, primarily because I was on my mission in England. And I'm like probably 3 months in, I'm still in my first area, and we're not allowed to listen to any music except for on preparation days, and it's like scripture soundtracks only. So it was terrible music for like 8 hours a week. So
The
I'm
olive
feeling.
tree over and over.
Yeah.
It's a good one, actually. It's a solid song.
I don't remember it. It must not have been allowed in our mission. Mr. President's like, this soundtrack is a little, they've got some talented musicians. This
Give
session
a little
artist, it's
edgy.
out. It's out. So anyway, I went to go get my haircut at this barber shop, and I go in to get my haircut, and a U2 song was playing. And you know how I felt about U2. I was like, oh, they're decent, they're nice. I never had the passion. I'm sitting there waiting to get my haircut, and I start crying. I'm like in tears. I'm like, this sounds so good. U2 is amazing. This is the greatest song I've ever heard.
Oh man, when
It's
you're on
like,
your mission and you're starved for music, anything will do,
it's
you
like your
know?
first date coming home. You're like, this is great. So that's basically that. And I was just like, so I've never forgotten U2. It has that positive, like, I don't know the song particularly. It didn't even really matter. Just that open tuning of the Edge's guitar. And I was just like, yeah, I can understand why these guys pack stadiums and sell so many tickets. This is God's own music.
So what, Mark, why do you think U2 is so just universally loved everywhere? Everyone
Yes,
likes U2.
everyone, everywhere.
that's a great question, man. It's got to be Adam Clayton, right? I mean, the guy looks like he's from the Jetsons, traveled back in time, right?
That's what I was going to ask you about. I was thinking about all the members of U2 so I could ask some questions, and I was like, yeah, obviously there's Bono, there's The Edge, Larry Mullen Jr. I'll remember forever because his name's hilarious. And then I was like, but who's the fourth guy? I couldn't remember. So I Googled members of U2, and I was like, oh yeah, Adam Clayton. So I clicked on his name, and then it brings up the Google image results, and I just couldn't stop laughing for almost an hour. Just looking at the various image results.
You know what's amazing about Adam Clayton is he's got this like really wide range of looks, you know?
Yeah.
Like he can pull off like a very distinguished gentleman, but he's also got his like Zoo TV Pop Mart kind of look that's like so far out there that,
And
you know,
when you
even
say
Bono and
pull
The Edge are like,
off,
what was he
what's your
thinking?
definition of pull off? Yeah, he's awesome. I just couldn't believe it. This photo from him on a some kind of evening talk show. The jacket, the collar, the hair, the like,
That hair is awesome.
it looks like
The
he's had a
ape
head
clip.
transplant. What's happening with his neck in that photo? Like, it's like a clear 6-inch wide scar where like someone else's head has been grafted on his, the pancake makeup didn't cover it or something. I don't know.
That's how you get
Well, that's
immortality. You
possible,
just
man.
keep putting your head on new bodies. I saw it in the X-Files. You
I
can do
think there was
that.
Twilight Zone episode about that too.
So, but let's talk about the
Yeah, let's
only
get
two
in.
members of the band that matter. So The Edge. How has he been able to make it so that people refer to him as The Edge?
Yeah, what's the deal?
I don't have a good answer for you on this one.
Here's a question for the whole group, but like, he goes by The Edge. People just call him The Edge and they know that. How many other great people from world history have included the word the in their name? There's like Alexander the Great, the Edge.
Did Prince ever have the in his name?
I don't think so.
I think he's the only one that's ever pulled off.
Oh, the Rock? Dave, goodness, Dave was about to say no one else has done it, and Mark just mentions he's supposedly one of his top favorite human beings?
Yeah, he's number two behind Vin Diesel. But The Rock and The Edge. I'd like to see those two get together. But I think...
How many other does are there?
I think it has something to do with he's always wearing like a real tight skull cap, and he's always got some type of goatee. And there's just something about his guitar playing. I always hear it described as angular. Mm. And that's how people are like, angular guitar playing. Like, he's the Edge. Sure.
It sounds like Ginsu knives slipping through the air, kind of.
What's the origin story of the Edge's nickname, Mark?
I think it's related to this idea of the angular sound. I mean, the like kind of blade of a knife. Mm. When they were early on, the Edge honed that sound at the beginning of the band.
Sharpened it.
In the earliest days of U2, and from the beginning, he called himself the Edge. Yeah. And it's a combination of the guitars he's used and the Vox amp and the delay.
So I did a little bit of research about him. He's got a brother named Dick.
Yeah.
Spells it D-I-K. I was like, well, what a family.
He was actually in U2 for a little while.
Was he?
When they first started out, yeah. But he was phased out for some reason. I'm not sure if he was kicked out.
I don't think he ever included the definite article before his name, though. That would have been too much. Competition with Bono.
Wait, if you phase your brother out of U2, like how could he ever forgive the Edge? Like his whole life, he's like Pete Best that got kicked out of the Beatles.
Except he doesn't have any of the hundreds of millions of dollars that the other members of U2 have because his brother kicked him out of the band.
He lives in a shack somewhere in Ireland. Here's my quick quiz for you. Do you know the Edge's real name and Bono's real name? Can you?
Oh, totally. Well, the Edge is Dave Evans.
Uh huh.
And Bono's is Paul Hewson.
Yeah.
Easy. Those ones are easy.
Well done.
Yeah, but what's Adam Clayton's real name?
The band, George Jetson.
There you go.
Little did we know that in the future, the Jetsons go from cartoon to real. They're able to develop the technology to become real people and travel back in time.
Explains the popularity of the band now. We got it all solved.
And they have technology in the future that develops an algorithm that can write the perfect song that makes it popular with people from the future. You can ask John Stoffer about that more.
Is that the technology that produced the pop album?
Yeah.
Just an album full of perfect songs.
The algorithm was still under development at that point.
So here's what I want to know. I just looked up, so the Joshua Tree, 1987?
Yeah, it's an old album.
No good music was really released by white artists in the 1980s. That was my standard, and no one had been able to produce a good counterfactual. And then Tree.
Whoa. No good music produced by white people in the 80s?
That's basically the standard. And then I found out about the Joshua Tree. I'm like, dang, this is amazing. This is like the gold standard for music by white people from the 1980s. And the other thing that's crazy is that they made great records in the 80s and then fell apart in the 90s. This is totally the flip of like every other rock band in world history. What happened? How did they do that? How were they great in the 80s? And dire in the 90s when everybody else was dire in the 80s and pretty good in the 90s.
You know, one thing that U2, at least, now I'm not going to comment on their more recent albums. One thing that U2 was never afraid to do was to move away from what they were doing in the past and try out something new. And sometimes when you're iterating and innovating like that, you have a few duds, you know?
I think someone described your PR guy. That's slick.
Someone described Octune Baby as when it first came out as the sound of cutting down the Joshua Tree. And, you know, I think it's true. I mean, it's a huge departure from one album to the next. And I wouldn't say that all of their 80s albums are great. I mean, Rattle and Hum has some great songs on it, but it's not, like, overall, I don't think it was super well received.
And, yeah.
But it was still great. Rattle and Hum's great. Come on, Mark. It was good.
The movie is awesome.
We left it long enough. Now we need to speak to Mark's true love affair. Dave, you got some questions for Mark about Bono?
So, is Bono, this is yes or no, is Bono the greatest frontman of all time?
Well, he's got a close tie with Stephen Jenkins.
not the most profound lyricist of our generation. The
greatest frontman. That's a good question. I mean, I think it's a valid debate. Who's had a longer running career than Bono as a frontman?
Mick Jagger, maybe.
Mick Jagger, yeah.
Maybe.
That's pretty much it.
He's right here.
In terms of like just dying. Length of years, yeah.
Not dying and actively performing.
Yeah.
So let's have this is a quick face off. So I'll Steel and Mark answer. So this is, we're going to be Bono versus other frontmen. Bono versus Thom Yorke. Who do you got?
Bono.
So I picked Thom Yorke, but not for charisma and for the human element, for the dancing. Dancing alone.
Bono versus Bon Jovi.
Easy. Bon Jovi.
John Bon. That's
wanted, dead or alive. Bono never sang that.
He's living on a prayer.
Yeah. He's halfway there. He used
but
to own like
the,
a.
He keeps the faith.
Yeah, he. And he owns like a minor league football team. Does Bono do that? No, he just forgives world debt. hardly
Bono
American.
Bono versus John Lennon.
Ooh, is John Lennon a front man? I mean, can you really call the split with Paul McCartney versus John Lennon, can you really call John Lennon a frontman?
Can you even call John Lennon a musician? What did he ever record that was any good, Dave?
Guys, go back, watch some videos, listen to the Beatles. Paul McCartney's bringing John down. It's John's group. They broke up because Paul thought he was bigger than he was. He's a little too big for his britches. It's John Lennon's band.
This is the first frontman. I'm going to pick Bono as the clear winner. Bono's hundreds of times better than John Lennon.
I really hope you're not being sincere right now. It hurts my feelings.
I would say even Sean Lennon is superior to John Lennon. John was just coasting on his son's fame, really.
Bono versus Jim Morrison.
Ooh, Bono for sure. Jim Morrison was unhinged.
Yeah. Plus, he had such a short-lived run.
Yeah, no longevity.
It's like two data points.
Yeah.
I think this is a legitimate, this is a good face-off,
this
one.
Good.
Bono versus Freddie Mercury.
That is a good one.
Way good. I don't know. I think both of them are, yeah, I don't know.
I think they're more similar than some of the other ones we've mentioned because they're both very charismatic and very, like, good at reading an audience.
Super closeted, both of them.
I think Freddie was out. Okay. I think he was okay.
I was going to say, the Bono versus Mick Jagger one's super interesting because, like, Mick Jagger is, like, openly standing for everything, sympathy for the devil, and Bono's, like, trying to, like, change the world and, like, sympathy for Jesus Christ. You know, they're, like, Christ versus Antichrist figures. They're, like, the polar opposites. That'd be a nice little...
Yeah, you know, I once heard someone say, asking someone whether they like U2 or the Rolling Stones is like asking them whether they like Dostoevsky or Tolstoy. I have no idea what that meant, but it blew my mind.
I don't even know who those names that you mentioned at the end are. Are those like brands of tea?
They're jeans. Oh, types jeans. Of jeans.
Tolstoy jeans. Button-ups.
High-end jeans. Yeah.
I think that Bono, honestly, I think he brings so much to the table as a front man. Like, I think he really does beat most of these guys. I think Freddie Mercury versus Bono is a pretty good face-off. Him versus Mick Jagger is pretty close. I think Bono gets him. And then the last two, it's like Bono wins. Bono versus Michael Stipe.
Yeah. Bono
is Roger Daltrey.
I don't even know that those guys are in the same kind of trajectory. I mean,
Minor league. Roger Daltrey is like double A, Dave.
Guys.
What about Bono versus Jethro Tull, that one guy that plays the flute? Jethro?
That's a close one, actually. The charisma of standing on one leg while playing the flute. Like, Bono doesn't have a move like that.
No, that's true.
So Mark, one memory I have of you, and I want you to expand on this a little bit. You were in a band in college, mm-hmm. and I remember you used to watch videos of Bono, of you two performing before you would go out and perform. Like, why were you doing that? What was going on?
It's all about the pregame, dude. I mean, you can ask, and if you ask Steele, he'll tell you it wasn't just before concerts that I was watching.
No, it was any time that he could find our room unlocked. Mark didn't have a computer, but we did, so.
I'll tell you what, the internet and having like access to videos like that just changed everything. For me, I always did take a lot of inspiration from like what Bono would do live to connect with his audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I just tried to do things like that when we played live, you know, I don't know.
He's
ways to like make the audience feel like they were part of the performance.
Yeah, Bono's super weird in that I feel like he's so interested in that, like, enormous, magnanimous gesture. Like, the attempt to make an arena full of people all welcomed into his enormous, hugely caring world. And it's a both impossible and, like, a seemingly 100% sincere move from Bono, which is, like, there's very little irony in that kind of messianic love that Bono like seems to exude in all of his performance.
Well, and so I've seen these guys four times in concert, and
in 2016, is that what you're saying?
I would say in 2016 I've seen them four times thus far this year, and I've got eight more tickets. No, but I do think that they like in two of those shows, I feel like Bono pulled that off. In two of them, I don't feel like there was a strong connection, but.
And he's unfortunately things haven't gone as well for Bono. I think he broke his arm really bad recently.
Surgery recently.
The world lost one of its great, great virtuoso guitarists with that bike accident.
And then, Mark, we don't have to talk about this very much, but what was your reaction to you two giving away their album and everyone basically being mad that you two gave them their album for free?
Mark's like, don't you guys remember Napster? We used to get all their albums for free.
Well, I mean, my initial reaction to them giving away free was like, awesome, U2 has a new album and they're giving it away for free?
Yeah.
But this idea of like pushing it to people's iPhones or to their iTunes, I thought was a little bit, I don't know. I mean, I read it as a little bit presumptuous, especially given the fact that it was like one of their lesser albums, I would say.
I don't know anyone that's actually listened to an entire song off of that album. Hey, have
yeah,
you?
Do.
And
yeah,
what's
you
your review?
You're talking to one right now.
I can sing any of the songs off the album for you if you wanted me to.
Probably just an 11 out of 10 on that record, Dave.
Not a 12, yeah. It's no Rattle and Hum.
No.
So I remember.
There is a song that captures, I think, this idea that Steele was talking about the magnanimous grand gesture called Every Breaking Wave. And it's basically about the flow of history, you know, this idea that like the waves of history breaking on humanity and the changes happening. And I think that was one of the first times that I realized, you know, you two really, I mean, I love their sound, but sometimes it is like a little grand, you know, it's a little over the top. Steele's laughing because he's told me this all along, right?
No, I think the thing that's so funny about this is like, I would be hard pressed to name like a U2 song or sentiment that wasn't hyperbolic. And that's part of what makes them great. But like, if there's a chance to use every or all or not, like, it's like, it's the emotional extremes, and they do it really, really well. But Bono is not like a master of nuance and lowercase storytelling. You know what I mean? In my opinion.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think that's true. It is all about the epic.
Yeah. Soaring.
So my favorite memory of Mark and his YouTube fandom is I made a bunch of us go see Wilco in Salt Lake City when we were in college. Again, Wilco was my favorite group at the time. I loved
it. Hall, right?
Yeah, I thought it was a great show. I think everybody enjoyed it.
Great.
On the way home, it's like 1 a.m. We're tired, and I just want to get home. Like, I really enjoyed the concert. Everything was great. And Mark says, we got to stop at Walmart. U2's new album had just come out. It, as the calendar had switched from at midnight to the next day, that's when you could first buy U2's new album. And so we had to go in, and we had to put it in my car on the rest of the ride home. And it was just like, after hearing my favorite band, to have to hear this U2 album for like 15 minutes on the way home, I almost fell apart. I couldn't handle it.
It was like drinking orange juice after you just brushed your teeth, huh? Oh,
that,
man,
is,
wait, well,
that is an awesome memory that, like, with perspective is amazing.
The perfect segue, Dave. What's our Unchained Melodies this week?
I'm excited.
15 minutes of U2.
We're picking the best from U2. And of course, it's extremely difficult to pick just 6 U2 songs.
Yeah.
But I'm still excited to have it. And guys, to kick it off, I have... This is genuinely, a little while ago, I compiled a list of songs that I felt were perfect, and which is kind of a ridiculous thing to try and compile, but this was on it. I love this song. It's my favorite U2 song by far. Like, it's not even close. Where the Streets Have No Name. And it takes forever to get going.
Jimmy to Zoom.
Yeah.
I got caught up in the moment. I forgot I had to fade it out.
I camped one night, literally in Joshua Tree National Park. And of course, the first song we listened to the next morning in the car as we drove out was this. And it was perfect.
Great. Great, great. All right, Mark, what do you got for us?
All right. So the first one I got is a classic song about love. Love lost. No. Who's going to ride your wild horses?
Thank you.
Mark, you made a YouTube, or you made a mixtape for me in college, and that was like either the it was one of the first or last songs on the on that CD. Every time I hear that CD or I hear that song, I think of that mixtape, and I think you're dangerous because you're honest. Opening lyrics.
Yeah.
So, Mark, you listen.
What do you got, Steele?
All right, I was gonna play something from Octoon Baby, but I think we should try to represent different records for every one of the songs. So. I'm going to go. I was asking Laurel and my wife, Laurel, the very first concert she ever went to go see. I think it may have been the second, but the first one she remembers, U2, Milwaukee, with her dad and her friend in like sixth grade or something like that. And I asked her what U2 song, what's her favorite one, what's the best one, and she said, play Sunday Bloody Sunday. I was like, geez, all right. So this is early U2 from the War album. There we go.
Is that the edge on harmonies there? Is that him?
Yeah.
Oh, he nailed it.
I hear that song and I'm like, oh my goodness, there's nothing in that song. That song already contains everything that Franz Ferdinand did, like with their whole career, for example, like in one song. I'm like, my goodness, like that's just one song from early U2 and it's already like more than many, many bands do in their whole career. So, yeah, amazing. Okay, so we played good songs by U2. Now we have each of us has like a lesser U2 song that we still picked, but let's do our lesser U2 song. Maybe that's editorializing.
That's terrible editorializing. If U2 reached the summit where the streets have no name, they just reached another summit with the next song that I'm picking here called All I Want Is You. Like this is Kilimanjaro. The first one was Everest, you know. It's still a summit.
Yeah.
You say you won't. Diamonds on the ring of gold. your story to remain untold. But all the promises we made, from the cradle to the grave, when all I want is you.
Yeah, that is a legitimately really beautiful song, Dave.
Thank you. Thank you.
Like you wrote it.
Those are my two favorite U2 songs, Where the Streets, and that's number two. So
they're interesting because the first one, it's like 2 minutes before Bono's voice appears. It's like it could be like this great instrumental. And then this one, like Bono's voice is there right away, and then the music kind of slowly comes in over the minute. But both of those songs, Dave, the guitars are right out of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, like when they went to the future. That's the guitar sound. And I think that's part of why you like those songs so much.
Well, and I think that's part of why we achieved world peace in the future, because those guitar sounds, if they're just constantly on in the background, you're not going to ever do anything evil or
no,
wrong.
Can't. Wild Stallions.
Your soul is constantly resonating.
liquid energy. All right, Mark, second choice.
All right, my second choice is the first track from their 2001 kind of comeback album, All That You Can't Leave Behind. It's Beautiful Day, and this song and this album came out while Steele and I were freshmen in college together, and it was a defining crossroads in our lives, and this album was like for me, is the soundtrack of that year.
Yeah, I was going to say, if we had iTunes at that time and it had play counts, we used Winamp, I think. But this would probably be 4 or 5 digits from that year alone, Dave.
The heart is a blue. Up through the stony ground, there's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck, and the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place.
What I love about that song is it captures the grandiosity of U2, so you know, a little bit of that over the topness.
Yeah.
But it's also got a sense of groundedness to it. You know, it's not terribly conventional song in terms of kind of U2's like kind of classic approach. Mm. And so it's got a little bit of a grounded feel to it, even though it is kind of the soaring.
For me, the greatest part about that song is it's so air drummable. It just calls out for somebody to be sitting there playing the air drums at their desk, you know? That's my most enduring memory of Mark Elison, him air drumming to Beautiful Day.
And
it's actually a pretty tough air drum.
Oh,
I'll let you know.
It looked tough.
You
were sweating at the end of that song.
Tambourine. There's an offbeat tambourine there. That, like, if you don't get that just right. You look like an idiot.
it's going to go one way or the other when you're air drumming. It's a fine line to walk.
So, Steele, play us out. This is the last U2 track that we got. What do you got?
So this was like a B-side from one of their early singles. I don't know the whole story, Mark. Sweetest Thing, where'd this come from?
It was a B-side from the 80s that Bono wrote for his wife for her birthday, because he forgot about her birthday and she was not super impressed with it. And then U2 released it as a single in the late 90s and made a bunch of money off of it.
Yeah, and this one's sweet because I didn't hear it until their Best Of album. And the video is kind of tender because it shows Bono sort of looking like a doofus for once instead of just like super earnest all the time. Like, I was like, yeah, all right. It did more to humanize Bono than anything else I had seen up to that point. I was like, all right, maybe he's not such a bad guy after all.
The most shocking thing, I can't believe Bono was married or is married. I didn't think he had a sexual identity.
He's monastic.
Yeah.
He's been married since he was 18. What? They got married straight out of high school. They've got like 5 kids.
Catholics.
Wow. Wow.
Steel, it's funny, the single version, so that's the B-side version.
Oh, okay.
And the single version they released in the 90s has Westlife doing the backup vocals.
For real?
Yeah, dude. That, the sweetest thing.
The Boyz II Men weren't available, huh?
they're in that video.
Cool.
I'm pretty sure.
One thing I never noticed about that song that makes me deeply uncomfortable are some of the lyrics. Something about she wants the driest kind of love. I was like, that doesn't sound comfortable or healthy. Dave, nurse, there needs to be some kind of lubrication.
I think he said bright kind of love.
Oh, okay. That's way better than the driest kind of love. Seriously, friction burn.
And on that note, thank you, Bono. Thank you for what you've done. And The Edge and Larry McMullen Jr. and even Adam Clayton, whose name we all learned today. So thanks for the music. Thanks for your expertise, Mark. And we're going to close this episode down with some book wisdom. I don't think it's Mark just reading Bono's lyrics, but Mark does have a passage for us.
So while we're thanking people, let's thank the Wright brothers for discovering how to fly.
Thank you, Wright brothers.
This is a passage from the Wright brothers' this recent biography that David McCullough put out on the Wright brothers.
Cool.
They went on their multiple times. They made these long trips to Kitty Hawk. And on the third time they went down to Kitty Hawk, they brought an engine and they were going to do, this was the first kind of human flight with an engine on the craft. And this is a passage of from the journal of one of the witnesses of that first time when the craft took off with the, and was like engine powered. So this means they took off from the ground and the engine gave them the lift and flew them into the air. Of those who had been eyewitnesses at Kill Devil Hills the morning of the 17th, John T. Daniels was the most effusive about what he had felt. "I like to think about it now," he would say in an interview years later. "I like to think about that first airplane, the way it sailed off in the air, as pretty as any bird you ever laid your eyes on. I don't think I ever saw a prettier sight in my life." But it would never have happened, Daniels also stressed, had it not been for the two workingest boys he ever knew. It wasn't luck that made them fly. It was hard work and common sense. They put their whole heart and soul and all their energy into an idea, and they had faith. And it just makes me think about you guys in this podcast and working hard and having faith, right? Having an idea.
But I genuinely like the thought of work. I think a lot of times I just want things given to me. I want things to be easier. But to really achieve something, I mean, as great as this podcast, you have to really work for it.
So who's Orville and who's Wilbur in this analogy? Because I'd really like to be Wilbur.
You can be it. I'll be Orville. I don't know the difference between the two, but I'm just excited.
So Orville was the one flying on that first flight.
Boom!
Yeah, but Wilbur probably built the engine. Boom.
Wilbur was like kind of the driving force originally behind like getting it started. So he's the one who wrote. So he got it all started by writing a letter to the Smithsonian, asking them for all the pamphlets and information they had on flight.
Really? That's pretty much how this podcast started. I wrote the Smithsonian, asked them for all their pamphlets on podcasting. They didn't have any.
I actually wrote them for all their pamphlets on The Rock and Vin Diesel, and there was a lot of information. So it's fueled a lot of our conversation.
Yeah, just wait till the next episode. I wrote them about the driest kind of love, and you should see some of the medical literature they sent.
Well, don't bring that up with your wife, Steele. But Mark, thanks for joining us. It's really been enjoyable. It feels like I'm 25 again rather than 35.
Good old days. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah. Thank you, guys. It's been good.
We'll see you next time. Off the chain. Off the chain.
So are you in a soulless hotel room somewhere in middle America?
No, this is actually my apartment.
It just looks like a soulless hotel room.
No, that's so mean. You got a ceiling fan.
I got a bookshelf over there.
Oh, that's nice. Some art up there, too.
That's a Thomas Kincaid original, Dave.
Oh, nice. That guy's talented.
Yeah, dude, check that out. It's actually a Van Gogh. Thomas Kincaid in the bathroom where I can enjoy it more.
You're making more money than I thought. Wow.
My broker.